Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a park in Flagstaff wants you to take off your shoes.
And Arizona is the second biggest pistachio provider in the United States, a Cochise farmer on this year's harvest.
But first, conservative activist Charlie Kirk was memorialized yesterday at State Farm Stadium, eulogized by President Donald Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, and his grieving widow and a new head of Turning Point USA, Erica Kirk.
My husband, Charlie, he wanted to save young men just like the one who took his life.
It was a moment of reflection and Christian worship amid a period of extreme division that his death has sparked. Since Kirk was shot by an assassin's bullet in Utah earlier this month, political rhetoric from all sides has ramped up. President Donald Trump and his administration have vowed to investigate extreme leftist organizations they claim helped lead to his death. And attempts to crack down on social media posts, jokes, and commentaries about Kirk have sparked a free speech reckoning we haven't seen in this country in decades. From late night host Jimmy Kimmel's suspension to dozens of teachers and professors who have been fired, to threats from Attorney General Pam Bondi to crack down on hate speech, it's all sparking swift backlash, including from some on the right. But our first guest this morning says Kirk was a fierce advocate of free speech. Paul Boyer is a former state lawmaker here in Arizona who penned an op-ed for the Arizona Republic arguing that Charlie Kirk was, quote, the best of us. This despite the fact that Boyer was at odds with Kirk's organization, Turning Point USA, after he refused to acquiesce to election denialism. Still, he told me he sees Kirk's legacy as more than about free speech or anything in the political realm.
It's more than a free speech thing. I mean, I think that Charlie ultimately cared about whoever was on the other end. I really think, and I've never met Charlie, but I think he really cared that he wanted to persuade whoever it was of the truth, whether it was political things or even spiritual things.
So you mentioned spiritual there, and you talk about that a lot in this op-ed, about his religious convictions as his almost most defining characteristic. You're saying beyond the politics, beyond his activism, you think of him as a religious man.
He was, 100%. And that was what was unique about Charlie, because anybody who's in the public eye – typically, especially elected officials, I know he wasn't elected, but he did have a political organization. They care about power. He didn't. He cared about his relationship with Jesus, and he wanted to share Jesus with anybody who would listen.
I want to ask you about Turning Point USA and that organization that he ran, because, I mean, you were not always friendly with them, right? I want to know what you make of that, given the legacy of Charlie Kirk that you're outlining there, because this is not an organization that you always agreed with.
Yeah, I mean, they might have had a beef with me when I was an elected official, but honestly, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter anymore. And honestly, I don't know that it really mattered back then. I mean, I was getting critics left and right, you name it. And after a while, you kind of just tend to tune it out. But again, I mean, that's neither here nor there. What matters most is, as I mentioned in the op-ed, is grace and redemption. And I really think that's what ultimately Charlie cared about.
I want to ask you about the circumstances in which this happened. It's a political assassination, essentially, in this time in which politics are very, very heated. And this has definitely turned up the heat on the conversation, on the rhetoric, on, I think, the stakes for a lot of people in politics. What do you think this says about the state of politics in this country right now?
That it's gotten so bad that you can't even share an opinion about what is true without risk of assassination. And that has to change. If we're going to be a self-governing country, we are a republic, and that means that we have representatives who represent us at the federal level, but we elect them to represent us. And if we don't have virtue, for lack of a better term, if we don't have excellence within ourselves, if we can't govern ourselves, then I don't know how long this country can last.
So you see this as a moment in which democracy is threatened?
People use the term democratic republic. We're a constitutional republic. And what that really means is we set the system up for ourselves as citizens, and we govern ourselves. And I do think that is at risk. If we can't fix this, if we can't make it better, where we can just talk to each other.
Let me ask you about talking to each other, right? Because this is an interesting moment for free speech. We're seeing a lot of talk about that, a lot of debate about what it means right now in this country. Charlie Kirk was, as you said, a big advocate for free speech. His willingness to debate was, I think, really defining of his style of politics. He was shot in the middle of a debate style part of his comeback tour, right? Like where he was saying, debate me, come up here and tell me I'm wrong, prove me wrong. What do you think Kirk would think of what's happening in this country in terms of free speech in the wake of his shooting, right? Like we've seen a lot of people fired for what they've said about him, including the suspension of late night host Jimmy Kimmel. We're seeing the president say maybe other broadcast networks should lose their licenses. A lot of people saying this is an assault on free speech.
He was clearly a fierce free speech advocate. Now, I never want to say what someone who is no longer with us, what they might have said, but just given his public comments, I don't believe, and this is just my opinion, that he would want Jimmy Kimmel, for example, fired for just what he said. Now, I do think that Disney made a business decision, but I think Charlie would say, yeah, I mean, he should have the right to say whatever boneheaded thing that he wants to say and not have to worry about losing his job as a result.
I wonder, we talked about political violence. You left politics and you were a politician who was willing to sometimes buck his party to the detriment of your own political career. What do you think about, I guess, the future of politics? Like, would you ever consider running for office again in light of the kind of landscape we're in right now?
I mean, I never say never. I don't have any concrete plans right now to run for office. But I could see myself running in the future, regardless of the dynamics, because I believe if God wants me there, I'll be there.
Do you think that fewer people will be willing to put themselves in that situation if, you know, they're worried that they will put themselves in danger or their families in danger by doing it?
I think more so not running for office, but certain votes. I think that elected officials will be a lot more judicious with upsetting either the base or take a vote that might lead to political violence.
Right. Which you did. I mean, you were willing to buck the party and go against the pressure from the party to say that the election was stolen. You never would do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because in good conscience, I couldn't vote for that come what may. And I've always believed that God will take care of me. And if that means paying the ultimate sacrifice, I mean, I could get hit by a bus tomorrow.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, as an elected official and someone who has a young son at home, I don't want my son to grow up without his father and my wife to live without her husband. I mean, based on a vote that I took and having to live with that, that would be devastating. And I can't even imagine what his wife and two kids are going to have to deal with over the next few decades.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder, Paul, like, where do you think we go from here? Like, the country feels broken in a lot of ways. I think the reality is violent in a lot of ways. In what way do you hope that this is a defining moment? What do you think that could mean?
Yeah. So do you want the true answer or the political one?
Both.
Okay. Well, let me give you the real answer. This country needs Jesus. We do. Let me explain. True Christianity is really radical. I mean, praying for those who persecute you, turning the other cheek, like in reality, that is the hardest thing to do. The hardest 10 words to say in the English language are 10 words. I'm sorry, I was wrong, will you please forgive me? Mm-hmm. I really think we need more of that. And I think the only way we get that is men and women who have given their lives to God and say, you know what, that is more important than whatever political win that I could ever get.
What's the political answer?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you hear it all the time. All the pundits say, oh, we need to dial down the rhetoric and we need to stop saying, words or violence, which is true, but ultimately it doesn't get to the root of the problem.
That's interesting. That is former state lawmaker Paul Boyer joining us. Thank you so much, Paul. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Reading scores among high school seniors are going down, according to the latest version of the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP, often referred to as the nation's report card. Last year's average scores were 3 points lower than in 2019 and 10 points lower than the first assessment in 1992. So how can we turn those numbers around? Our next guest has some ideas. Jessica Early is a professor of English education at ASU. She spoke with our co-host, Mark Brody, who asked if anything she saw in the latest NAEP scores surprised her.
No, the scores don't surprise me at all. And the trends in these scores have been going down since prior to COVID and continue to slide. What's interesting about the scores, and it continues to upset me and other people invested in education, is that the disparity between students who have and students who do not have is widening. So students who are struggling more and more, and there's more students who are struggling than ever before. But the students who are doing well are doing better, if that makes sense. So it's like both sides of the map are further and further apart, which is not a good trend.
Yeah. I would imagine that maybe makes it more difficult, perhaps, to try to figure out the way out of this.
Yeah. Although we know a lot about how to teach students to read, and there's a ton of research out there and best practice about what works in teaching students to read and the science of reading, and blended with holistic approaches. We need to fund schools and train teachers and give teachers time to teach students and to invest in reading and writing and in literacy across grade levels and disciplines. I also think that we've seen a big shift in schools away from teaching novels and texts that students really connect to because of the Common Core. The Common Core emphasizes nonfiction reading more than fiction. Doesn't mean you can't do both, but I think we've sort of gone to an extreme of cutting out a lot of books and texts that students more easily connect to and see themselves in terms of experience. Students used to read, you know, 8 to 9 novels a year in high school English classes, and now they're reading like 2.
Is there some part of the fact that students are reading fewer novels? Is part of that because teachers or maybe schools or districts are concerned about backlash from particular novels that they might assign to students?
That's one of the things. So we know now more than ever that texts are always highly contested, but they're more contested than they've ever been. And there's recently been a report released by the National Council for Teachers of English. And one of the things that report shows is that teachers, for the most part, really value teaching texts, literature from diverse perspectives, but they don't feel comfortable in their school context to do so. And the majority of books that are being taught in high schools are the books that our parents read and even their parents read. So I think things like that are really problematic. Books are really complicated and they show all different perspectives and lenses. And that's what reading's about.
How is this impacting other aspects of school? Like if students are not strong readers or confident readers, or maybe even interested in being readers, what does that mean for their non sort of ELA, you know, English language arts subjects in school?
Well, one of the things we're noticing at the university level, and there's recent studies showing this, is that professors who are teaching writing across all the disciplines at the university level are seeing exactly this, that students are coming to college and they don't have familiarity with close reading and with close and sustained long texts. And I think this is an invitation for all of us who work in the K-12 setting, whether we're PE teachers or art teachers or English language arts teachers, to invite students to use texts in sustained, important, and real ways to gather information, to make sense of their ideas, and to learn more about who they want to be in the world. I also think a huge factor that we haven't talked about yet, that's sort of sitting, it's the elephant in the room, is that students are reading all the time on their phones.
Yeah.
And they're involved in texting and making text and reading all sorts of communication. It's just different than the kind of reading that my generation or your generation took part in or outside of school. And it's not that that kind of reading isn't important, but it's a really kind of different kind of attention span. And we want students to be able to do both things.
Well, it's interesting because I would imagine, you know, especially now that so many schools and districts have, you know, phones off, phones in your backpack, away for the day kinds of policies, like you have some number of hours during the day almost to get kids hooked on traditional literature or something that's not in 140 characters or, you know, on their phones necessarily. So I wonder if that's maybe an opportunity during the school day when students cannot be on their phones in many cases to really try to get them interested in literature, to then get them to carry that through after school on the weekends when they're not in the classroom, when they do actually have access to their phones.
Absolutely. And this is what we know. We know that when students have access to texts that they see themselves in, that they're engaged with, that catch their attention, that they have some choice and investment in. I think having teachers provide some book choice and libraries that are full of books that are interesting and compelling to students, providing books that are audio and visual as well as, you know, analog. You know, the more schools can do that, this to captivate students' attention when they have them in those school hours, the better.
Well, how do you try to find the balance between sort of the classics, you know, the stories that, you know, the books that you and I read in school and our parents maybe even read in school, versus more contemporary stories, more contemporary novels that students maybe will see themselves in or see the world in which they're living in? Like, does there have to be some of each to really be successful here?
I think so. And it's a great question. And one of the things we know about how to do this is I think it's really important to read classic texts for all sorts of reasons. But I also know that we have all these rich, beautiful, amazing, diverse texts that we can pair with those classic texts. But I think finding ways for students to connect to all different diverse topics is really important. I do think one of the most important things is that testing in our country of any kind has really, you know, we have to assess and test students, but I also think a lot of the tests are testing in the same way they always have, and that reading's really changed. They're, you know, learning to read and the process of learning how to decode words is the same, but there's such a variety of text now, digital, multimodal, analog, Kindle, audio. And I think we need to also think about the way we assess students and how they read and think about kind of expanding the notion of what counts for being a successful reader. It's not always just a test score.
All right. That is Jessica Early, a professor of English education at ASU. Jessica, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Of course. Take care.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, Arizonans love a good hiking trail, but would you ever take a walk while barefoot?
Outside in nature, on dirt, grass, sand, even sometimes concrete if it's directly on the earth. So no shoes, no socks, just your skin touching the natural ground or natural elements. Any of these natural elements create that exchange for our bodies with the earth's electrical field.
We'll hear more about the country's first quote-unquote grounding trail in Flagstaff.
But first, if you're a regular user of the New York Times cooking app or a serial scroller of food-focused social media feeds, you may have noticed that pistachios are having a moment. As the BBC's food blog asked earlier this year, why are we going nuts for pistachios? The flavorful green snack is popping up everywhere, from chocolates to cocktails. And it turns out a significant number of them are grown right here in Arizona. The state's arid climate is ideal for pistachio crops, and early to mid-September, it turns out, is prime picking season. Jim Graham is the owner and manager of Cochise Groves, a farm southeast of Tucson that grows pistachios, and I caught up with him last week for an update on this year's harvest.
Right now, I'm sitting in my farm office observing my pistachio harvest that's going on outside.
Oh, tell me what that looks like. What do you see right now?
Well, I'm watching a custom harvester handle our harvest. It takes a shaker that shakes the trees and a catcher that catches the nuts as they fall off the tree before they hit the ground. And we have three sets of harvesters working in our orchard right now. We're about halfway done with our harvest this year and always happy to be into harvest and look forward to being done.
Yeah, I can imagine. So how long is the growth cycle that leads up to this moment? When were the pistachios that are being harvested planted?
These trees were planted around 1980. So they're 45-year-old trees. They're about 20 feet tall, and they're spaced in rows 17 feet wide and 17 feet apart in the row. And our operation, we have roughly 21,000 trees to harvest.
21,000 trees. Wow.
Yeah. Pistachios are alternate bearing. They'll have a big crop one year and a smaller crop the next year. And this is our smaller crop.
So how many pounds of pistachios do you expect to come out of a small harvest? And how does that compare to a bigger harvest?
Our alternate bearing swings are pretty wide. These older trees produce typically a very heavy crop on their on year. We can have somewhere in the range of 4,000 to 5,000 pounds of nuts per acre. And in an off year, we'll have roughly a quarter of that. And the reason for it is the fruit on a pistachio tree is produced on new growth that occurred last year. So on a year where there's a big crop, all the energy pretty much goes into raising the crop that's on the tree, and there's not much new growth that takes place. So there are fewer fruiting sites the following year, and thus there becomes this alternate bearing cycle where heavy years and lighter years.
Got it. Let me ask you, I mean, probably a lot of us have had the experience of getting a bag of pistachios that are in the shells, splitting open the shells, taking out the little green nuts. How different is the product that is currently being plucked off of your trees from what ends up in that bag of pistachios that we get, say, at Quick Trip?
When we harvest these nuts, they have a hull on the outside of the shell. It's called an epicarp. And that epicarp needs to be removed within 24 hours after the harvest to keep the hull from staining the shell. We, in the U.S. industry, have worked really hard to make sure that we don't have blemishes on the shell. People would remember that a lot of pistachios were dyed red, and the red dye was simply to cover up the brown stains that can occur on the shell.
Well, I don't remember this period of pistachios being red. How long ago was that?
Well, the pistachio industry in the United States is relatively young. The first commercial crop of pistachios was produced in the mid-1970s, which in the terms of the length of the age of the trees and things like that, it's not that old of a crop.
Right.
The main producer of pistachios before the 1970s was Iran, and their harvesting and processing technology caused a lot of staining on the shells, and most of the stained shells would get dyed red.
So was that purely an aesthetic thing?
Yes. It just made them more aesthetically pleasing not to see brown spots on the blonde shells.
So how did the U.S. come to stop dyeing them red and instead try to just remove the coloration altogether?
Well, I think the public themselves recognize that this is not the way pistachios should look. And again, the technology has improved in the last 50 years with the timeliness of harvest, the processing period and being able to, you know, put a natural product in the hands of consumers.
And Arizona is a pretty major pistachio producer, right?
Yeah, we like to brag about it. Arizona is the second leading producing state in the country. California produces 98%. We produce 1.5%, but we are number two. We are number two.
It's a short list, but we're on it.
It is. Yes. Yes.
And I understand you have a phrase about pistachios that you like to use to market them.
Yeah. We tell people, I bet you can't eat just 50. And 50 is a normal serving when people sit down to eat the nuts. That's about 2 ounces.
Can I ask you, Jim, you know, we've heard a lot of stories from the agricultural world about the impact of tariffs recently.
Well, we are certainly aware of them. And because the biggest part of the U.S. pistachio production gets exported to Europe and to Asia, yes, we're very concerned about tariffs. We don't like the idea of creating a unnecessary confrontation with countries that we want to be able to ship our pistachios to.
Okay. And what about from a labor standpoint? I mean, that's been another big storyline in agricultural communities is loss of labor due to the ongoing immigration crackdown. Have you dealt with any of that?
We are also concerned about that and monitor it closely. We are a diversified farm. We also have a vineyard. We produce wine under our Golden Rule Vineyards label, and we rely very heavily on workers that come in and do a lot of handwork in the vineyard. And we cherish these people that come and are willing to work and do this kind of work. And we like to see good, honest people being able to come and get jobs in the U.S. So I'm a proponent of legal immigration, and we rely quite heavily on people to come and help us with our production.
Well, last question for you, Jim. You mentioned that the name of your vineyard is Golden Rule. What is that name a reference to?
We like to treat other people the way we want to be treated. We produce things that we hope that people can enjoy, both the pistachios and the wine. And we're relatively successful in being able to provide products to people that we would want to consume ourselves.
Well, Jim Graham is the owner and manager of Cochise Groves Farming and Golden Rule Vineyards. Jim, thank you very much and good luck on the rest of the harvest.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. This weekend saw a major shift in Middle East policy from some influential foreign governments. And there's sure to be a lot of focus on those changes this week as nations from around the world gather in New York City. Joining me now to talk about that, as well as some other big stories happening internationally, is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. Rob, as world leaders head to New York for the UN General Assembly, what are you keeping your eye on?
Yeah, so this is a big jamboree that happens every year at the UN General Assembly in New York, and thousands of delegates from all over the world, lots of different countries and regions turn up. And of course, they usually have all their own kind of agendas, you know, what's important to them in their country and in their region. So there's a lot of different discussions and speeches and all that sort of thing going on in New York. One thing that I think is eye-catching and interesting and very topical at the moment, and that is that over this past weekend, Britain, Canada, Australia, and Portugal all recognized a Palestinian state. And of course, there is no such thing as at the moment it's notional. But what they're trying to do, these four countries, is put pressure on Israel to think about and put back on the agenda, if you like, the idea of a two-state solution to finally bring some sort of peace and equilibrium, if you like, to the Middle East. So these four countries formally recognized a Palestinian state. And in fact, if you go to the Foreign Affairs website of the Foreign Office here in London, a few days ago, you would have seen these areas of Gaza, of the West Bank, of East Jerusalem. You would have seen them described as occupied areas, places that are occupied by Israel. Well, now they're actually described as Palestine. So, you know, this is a clear change. I should say that these four countries, these are Israeli allies, so they are putting pressure on an ally by doing this. The real focus is to try and get the idea of a two-state solution kind of back on the drawing board. One other quick thing that caught my eye was the Syrian leader, who is a former jihadi, let's not forget. He is in New York. He will be speaking at the podium. He's the guy that got rid of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. He's called elections for October, and he's been welcomed in New York and will actually speak, making him the first Syrian leader in about 50 years to address the United Nations General Assembly. So a lot to look forward to this week, a lot of interesting things in New York.
Yes, first in 50 years. Wow. Well, let's shift gears slightly here, Rob. There's also big developments in South Korea this week. There will be a big case going to trial. It features the head of the Unification Church, what some people refer to as the Moonies. Tell us more about this.
Well, the Unification Church, not everyone will know this, of course. They're known formally as the Family Federation for World Peace and Unification, which is quite a mouthful. They were founded in South Korea in the 1950s by Moon Sun Myung, and that's why they're called the Moonies, from his first name. He proclaimed himself the Messiah. The church is best known for holding mass weddings involving thousands of couples, many of whom don't actually know each other very well before they get to the altar. And critics have described the group as cult-like. So that's the background. The kind of foreground is that the head of the Unification Church, who is the wife of the man, Moon, who actually started it all, as I've just described, she is in the dock on bribery charges. And specifically, what is alleged is that she gave expensive gifts to the former first lady of South Korea in return for business favors and that kind of thing. The former first lady is Kim Kyon-hee, and she is in the dock accused of bribery and stock manipulation, which she denies. But prosecutors say that she made over $600,000 by participating in a price rigging scheme. And indeed, when she was arrested for this and put in jail, she joined her husband in jail. He was, rather bizarrely, he called martial law, effectively staging a military coup or trying to in South Korea at the end of last year. And for those activities, he was prosecuted and jailed. So bizarrely, we had the former first lady and the former leader of South Korea both in jail at the same time. And that is the case that we're looking at this week. But it really has all sorts of interesting complexities.
Yes, a lot of big ideas to kind of wrap our heads around in those first two stories, Rob. Let's end on somewhat more concrete terms. In Germany this week, we're expecting an announcement about the state of the railways. What will be announced and why does it matter?
Well, this is interesting because certainly in this country, when you think about Germany, you think of efficiency, you think of things like public transport running on time. You know that if you book a train from, you know, Frankfurt to Cologne, you're pretty sure that that train's going to run on time and that you can build your schedule, your holiday or whatever around that. Well, actually, that's not really been the case in Germany for some years now. And the state-owned Deutsche Bahn, DB, gets quite a lot of flack from the public and from people visiting Germany in terms of its punctuality, in terms of the infrastructure that it uses and the state of the rails and the state of the rolling stock and so on. If you look online, you'll see, you know, lots of articles have been written about this and what's happening to Germany. And is this a sign of what is actually a sort of economy that's been flagging recently? Is this a sort of a symptom of that? So it's interesting to see that the transport minister in Germany this week is announcing an overhaul of Deutsche Bahn, the state-owned rail network. Recently, he fired the guy that actually runs it. And so we're expecting potentially a new name to pop up as the CEO of Deutsche Bahn. But it's an interesting development for a country that, again, we really associate with efficiency and things being on time. So we're looking at that this week to see if if anything really interesting comes out of how is Germany going to overhaul its rail network?
Yes, yes. Well, lots of realignments, both literal and figurative, happening this week, Rob. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones keeping us in the loop. Thank you as always, Rob.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Sam, do you ever like to take off your shoes, walk around barefoot?
I'm more of like a cozy socks sort of person.
I'm pretty big on my high heels, I gotta say. But my kids are always barefoot at home. And our next guest would say that's all the better for them. Leah Williams is the founder of the Barefoot Trail. She says it's the first so-called grounding trail in the United States. And it's located just outside of Flagstaff in Belmont, Arizona. Now, if you've never heard of grounding or earthing, as it's sometimes called, you're not alone. But Williams told me it's popular in Europe and has some major health benefits in her point of view. And if nothing else, it gets you outdoors.
Basically, grounding or earthing is when you make direct contact with the earth. So when you're walking barefoot on grass or sand or in the water, we absorb the earth's natural electrical energy. So it's the process of that energy exchange with the earth.
Yeah. So describe what's happening here. I mean, literally, this is just walking barefoot outside on kind of different textured surfaces, right?
It is, yes, yes. Outside in nature, on dirt, grass, sand, even sometimes concrete if it's directly on the earth. So no shoes, no socks, just your skin touching the natural ground or natural elements. You know, at the park, for example, we have wood or sand or dirt. We have water. We have mud. Any of these natural elements create that exchange for our bodies with the earth's electrical field.
Is this about creating balance? That's kind of what this reminds me of, the ideas you hear about in New Age practices like reflexology or something you might hear at a vortex in Sedona.
Yes, exactly. And it is. It is a way of balancing out the things that we absorb and we accrue as we go on, you know, throughout our day. And grounding every day for about 20 to 30 minutes does help us restore that natural electrical balance in our bodies.
Tell us about your experience with this, Leah. Like, where did you come across this? Where did you try it? What did it feel like?
That's a great question. So my first experience with an actual designated, created park or space for this particular kind of activity was when I was living in the Netherlands. My children were attending an international school, and they went on a field trip to Belgium. And they came back just raving about it. They absolutely loved it. And of course, then we had to go as a family. So we went to the park and visited, and I absolutely loved everything about it. It just struck something in me. It was really an aha moment for me. And I thought, wow, why don't we have these in the United States? They have more than 70 different parks like this throughout Europe. Many of them are located in Germany, but they're spread throughout. South Korea has a whole bunch of parks now, thousands, in fact. The government supports nature parks and walking barefoot and grounding. And Japan is picking up speed in that area, too. So this is not just area specific.
Okay, so describe the trail that you've created there in Flagstaff. This is, you say, the first in the country.
It is the first designated park that I'm aware of. And I do a lot of my own research. So, we have 13 acres of ponderosa pine forest. It's a 1 mile manicured trail. In fact, we manicure it every morning for about 2 hours. We keep all the pine cones and rocks and the things that you wouldn't want to step on. And we've made this beautiful sanded space for you, as well as, you know, natural dirt, of course. And then we've got 35 different integrated at what we call adventure stations and activity segments based off of reflexology. So all kinds of things for your foot to experience and explore.
So tell me about when you first did this with your kids. Like, they come home, they say this was fun. You go and you do it with them in Europe. What did you think? Like, how did you feel the first time you did it?
Oh, I loved it. I grew up in Seattle, so the environment that I experienced the trail for the first time in Belgium was very similar to what I experienced in the Seattle area growing up. And we were often barefoot. So my family immigrated to the United States from Germany in the 1950s. And I remember my grandfather and also my mother saying many, many times, go out, be barefoot as children. We would just run around. Mm-hmm. So we were always barefoot as kids. So it was a very, very easy pivot. You know, being at the park in Belgium, you know, really was nostalgic for me. I felt like a child again, or, you know, just experiencing that childhood freedom of being able to explore and, you know, experience the world through my feet, right? We've got 200,000 nerve endings in our feet. And so when we are barefoot, that communicates a lot to our brains and our bodies about what we're doing, you know, with our bodies when we're stepping on the natural ground. So there's a good, strong communication. We have our shoes on. You don't necessarily get that communication because it insulates us.
It's really interesting. I have a baby, and they say this about babies in development, that you should put their feet barefoot on, you know, grass or the ground, and it helps with their development. Sounds like what you're saying here.
Yes, it's the same. Doesn't matter how old you are. It's just so helpful in that development, especially for babies' feet as their feet are forming. All of our foot problems come from shoes, or I should say many of them do.
I mean, Leah, do you ever get folks who come to do this and just say, this all sounds crazy to me?
Yes, yes. And I let them keep their shoes on if they really want to. It's not just grounding. It's not just reflexology and those health benefits, but it is. It's time outside. It's unplugging from technology. It's integrating with the forest, you know, and the therapies that naturally come in. They say once you even just see trees or smell trees, your cortisol drops, you know, your stress is reduced. People are happy being in the forest and outside in nature. So there's a lot of different elements that are incorporated into the park experience. Grounding is just simply one of them.
All right. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show to tell us about it. That is Leah Williams, the founder of the Barefoot Trail outside of Flagstaff, joining us. Leah, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Lauren. I appreciate letting me speak about the park, and hopefully, you know, we invite everybody to come and try something new.
You can just barely feel a change in the air here in Phoenix, or maybe you can't quite feel it yet, but according to the calendar, at least, fall is here, which makes it the perfect time to wrap our summer series of soapbox essays on the topic of misbehaving. Local storyteller Susan Lakey is an accomplished academic with fancy degrees. She also happens to be deaf. Here she is with a story about the one college class that tripped her up.
In order to graduate college, students must take at least one semester of a foreign language. French, Spanish, Chinese, whatever. That's the problem for me. I'm deaf, and this accent should make it clear that I have enough trouble with the English language, much less Chinese. But I had to do it. You see, when I lost my hearing at the age of 2, my parents had a problem with that. They didn't want to learn sign language. They wanted a normal kid. So from the time I was 2 until the time I was 21, I spent hours each day learning to speak and lip read. This accent, it took a lot of work. But I needed a college degree. So to fulfill the foreign language requirement, I saw one class that would work. American Sign Language. I laughed at the irony. I mean, I'm deaf. This is my language. These are my people. How hard could it be, really? As it turned out, pretty hard. No matter how much I stared at the professor in class, all I could understand was the alphabet. A, B, C, D, E, F. I saw the letter F a lot on my test, including the midterm, after which my professor suggested I get a tutor. God bless Megan, who met with me after class each week to practice sign language. She was patient and kind. I'd say things like, I work in the office, and she'd correct me, saying, no, 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 this is work. What you signed was the F word. Megan and I practiced for weeks, and still all I could remember was the alphabet and the F word. When we sat down next to each other to take the final exam, she wished me good luck with sign. I had no idea what she said. The teacher began the exam. She said number one and then signed a sentence. For each sign, we had to choose the translation from multiple choice options on a paper test. By the time she hit number 2, I knew I was doomed. I was going to fail, and I would never graduate, all because I was a deaf girl who couldn't sign. I looked down and tried not to cry. Then, out of the corner of my eye, I saw something move. It was Megan's hand under the desk, waving the letter B. The alphabet! I know the alphabet! It's literally the only thing I know! Did I cheat on my sign language exam? Yes. But I graduated college. And then I got my master's degree. And then my doctorate. And then I went to therapy, which is where I sort of started. I didn't know then, but I do now. The biggest gift you can give someone is meeting them where they are. Megan helping me cheat on my sign language exam was the first time I had ever felt seen. I mean, yeah, I wanted to graduate, but what I needed was for someone to say, what if we just stop trying to make normal happen? Because clearly it's not happening here. So, whatever normal you've tried and failed to achieve, please know that I see you and I celebrate you. Because accepting what I'm not finally opened the door to be proud of who I am. Now I own it. I'm a deaf girl who doesn't sign. Well, that's not entirely true. I know how to sign the alphabet. Also, the F word. As it turned out, that's all I really need.
That was Phoenix storyteller Susan Lakey. You can hear the rest of our Soapbox essays at kjzz.org.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you tomorrow morning with much more. Thanks for joining us. Don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.